Okay, this is Friday, June 24th, 2016, and I'm on the phone with Mr. Craig Pincus, a lawyer in Indianapolis. I became aware of Craig Pincus in 1970 or 71. I was living in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, and I started to get Craig's Zappa fan letter idea. It wasn't just a fan letter. It had all kinds of interesting ideas in it, reviewing albums and stuff. And that was in 70, 71. And I don't think I ever spoke to Mr. Pincus back then, but he may have corresponded a bit. Now, what I remember, Craig, was you reviewing just another band from L.A. and talking about how people were suppressing hearing what Zappa was really singing about. You brought in the idea that he was talking and addressing people's subconscious or what they didn't want to be conscious of. And there was a lot of repression, I guess that's the word you used, going on in responding to Frank's work. That was probably the first time I ever heard anybody say that about Frank. It's probably true, but do you recall saying those kind of things?
Excuse me just a second. I've got to respond to something.
Okay, it's all right.
Okay, I'm with you. Sorry.
Okay, I just want to add that Craig's newsletter, fan letter, was called Mother's Home Journal. And I think you told me that Frank named it that?
He did, yes. We discussed the idea in advance of the first issue, and I sent him a little logo I created for it, which I applied with a rubber stamp. Had a rubber stamp made in the design,
mm-hmm.
and had a couple of ideas about names. And Frank said, "Call it Mother's Home Journal," and that is what it was called.
Right. So before I go back to a little point before this, I just asked you, do you remember me? I remember those ideas about just another band from L.A. being showing or people not really hearing what Frank was talking about and a lot of repression going on, a denial. Do you remember saying that idea?
Well, do I specifically remember writing it or saying it? What was this, 1971?
Yeah, thinking it, say. Remember thinking it. Do you remember thinking it?
Oh,
least?
Sure, of course.
Right,
I mean,
right.
That's obviously true of Frank and all kinds of other artists whose work is significant on several levels simultaneously, has many meetings simultaneously.
Right.
You
okay.
Know, an idea exhaustively considered, at least in Shakespeare scholarship and countless artists since.
Did you say you noticed that? Is that what you just said? In countless artists?
Oh, of course.
All right.
Oh, of course.
Okay, so let's...
Yeah, I mean, for example, Flo and Eddie...
Yes?
...have just been commenting about their new box set that they're going to issue... And Mark Volman is quoted within the last day or two about how actually their simplistic sounding songs had foundational ideas that were political and had some edge and reflected the times, and they were saying something serious, but it was obviously very sugar-coated. And with Frank, of course, that was even more profoundly true of all kinds of his things.
So what you're bringing this up about their career in the Turtles, I mean, are they overreaching when they're saying that, or are you giving them the credit, the benefit of the doubt there, that they're turtle happy together and... Whatever other songs they did, you're saying
right.
You're saying they're exaggerating?
No, I mean, I take... Mark Volman's a very smart guy, and I know that firsthand,
yes.
And I have no reason to disbelieve what he says. I mean, the creative process is so often different than what the recipients of the product imagine.
Yes.
That's, you know, that's a commonplace story.
Okay. So
I wrote this because of that. I was thinking this, and, you know, the world
right.
has no idea.
Okay, so that means you knew Frank for how long before he and you started the Mother's Home Journal? Like a year or two?
I'd say a couple of years. We were communicating, yeah.
Did you, like myself, enter into awareness of Frank through Freakout first?
I think I don't date my awareness to an album.
Hmm.
Frank's influence was in the air. I was going to law school in Cambridge, and Bob Dylan was performing in local coffee shops, and a great deal of the most influential music to come out of the mid-60s and, you know, blossom later was in the air, and Frank was in the air. I do remember my first copy of Freakout I acquired by accident. And that is unexpected. I mean, in the days of vinyl mass production, mistakes were made. So I bought an album by another artist, and I opened the cellophane, and out came Freakout, which was, it was in the wrong cover.
Did you ever read Susie Rotolo's book on her life with Bob Dylan?
No.
Because she talks about the scene in Cambridge. You're talking about up near Boston, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So you were there. So that means you were born in the early
40s? 1943.
Almost Frank's age. So
a little bit younger.
Right. So you were responding to the folk scene before Frank came into your awareness.
No, I was aware of it. I didn't think it was musically very interesting. And still don't. My musical roots, as a pre-teenager in Indianapolis, Indiana, are very specific. The Indianapolis area was featuring a jazz scene of some significance. More or less self-taught drummer with almost no equipment, but somehow or another, a boyhood friend of mine and I stumbled onto a man whose name was Sonny Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And Sonny Johnson was a drummer, and Sonny Johnson said he would give us drum lessons for free, and that was the right price. We walked or hitchhiked to his house when we could. There was no regular schedule. And every once in a while, Sonny Johnson would say, stick around, because members of the band he was playing with would be coming to his residence to rehearse. And so I sat on the floor at the age of 12. And watched this little group rehearse. And in this little group were the Montgomery brothers, including Wes Montgomery.
Wow.
Yeah. And so jazz was my mother tongue, and obviously it was important to Frank as well, although he maybe did not discuss it as broadly as other influences, but
yes.
The complexity of the music impressed me as a kid, and we continued to have a wonderful jazz scene in Indianapolis, which I could only participate inadvertently, or you know, when something happened to be free.
Yeah.
But we had great artists here, and a few still survive. But you know, we had Freddie Hubbard and on and on.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of great artists. So that interest in what I'll call complex music also influenced me. There was a great deal of symphonic and operatic music in a collection of 45s that my father had, and I would listen to that. And so while I love beautiful, simple, melodic lines, I've always been drawn in most to complex music, and a guy with a harmonica sitting on a stool and maybe a guitar too didn't get me.
How old would be Sonny Johnson in that period?
When Sonny was teaching us, he would have been maybe very early 30s.
Okay, so relatively young.
The jazz scene was, life worked differently. The ability to travel was limited. And even after Wes Montgomery became a world figure in music, he would not fly.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, the ubiquity, the physical presence of artists was a comparatively rare event. They stuck mostly around here.
Yeah. In high school and that, did you listen to doo-wop or any of the 50s music that would be part of your life?
I thought it was an object of ridicule. And I thought the music often categorized as bubblegum was offensive.
You know, I've met many. I knew a music professor in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and he was an American. And this would be in the 70s, and I would talk to him about Zappa, but he would say, I was not ready for what Frank was combining, because as a teenager, I was into jazz. I've met many people your generation who, once they got into jazz, they didn't respond to teen music at all. You know what I mean? It was like,
yes, but I was broader than that. Frank, of course, loved all kinds of classical music, especially 20th century. I remember one night when I was on the road with him, and we sat, and he had some of the earliest editions of miniaturized speakers, we listened to a recording of Stravinsky's Aegon. And I'd been listening to Stravinsky since about the same era, 11 or 12 years old. And his love of Edgard Varèse and other significant composers of the mid-20th century, I shared that as well. There was a lot of musical vocabulary, and the least experience I had was with the pachuco culture in L.A. and environs that obviously influenced him quite a bit, too.
Right. So how did you first meet Frank? Did you seek him out, or did you bump into each other?
Yeah, I did. I first met him talked to him backstage at a concert in Indianapolis shortly after I was practicing law. I began practicing law in 1968, and the concert was here at the Indianapolis Fairgrounds Coliseum, which was one of the only venues that had some size. And Gail was there, and Being a lawyer and being a little more glib, I think, than ordinary fans, I just talked myself into the backstage, and the backstage was really not a backstage at all. The Coliseum is a place for, it's a show ring, essentially, for horseback riding and judging animals and things like that. And the backstage area was nothing more than a public corridor, but it was cordoned off with a couple of security people. We talked for a while, and then I started becoming aware of other fans whose musical interest was, I'll say, a little more than superficial. One of them was Vaughn Wiester, a trombone player from Columbus, Ohio, who went on to do some big band things. And I got to talk to Frank at a few concerts for a little while, but one day Vaughn Wiester got in touch with me, probably wrote a letter. The subject was, he read the Warner Circular.
Yes, that'd be 1971, right?
Yeah. He read in the Warner Circular that a guy named David Wally was writing a book about Frank and needed bibliography or other kinds of more or less scholarly content.
Yes.
Or at least more serious content than gossip. And so he said, get in touch with the guy, which I did, and that led to a lot of continuing dialogue with Frank, which led Frank to invite me out, and he was living in Laurel Canyon still, so I went out for a week.
But let me just interrupt you there. You're saying that you got in touch with Dave Wally?
Uh-huh, yeah. I did the bibliography for the first edition of No Commercial Potential.
Wow, I was a proofreader of it. I met him in 70 or 71 when he was writing for the East Village Other, same time as I guess you did. And I stayed at his place in November 71 at the premiere for 200 Motels, and he was very upset because he and Frank were starting to have a falling out over the book.
Oh, yeah.
So I heard him commiserate about that, and I read the book. I read whatever the manuscript was at that point. Mm-hmm. So we both were involved with Dave Wally at the same time. That's amazing. I had visited Don Van Vliet in the summer of 71 up in Ben Lomond, California, and when he didn't know Dave Wally or anything, but when I told him that Wally was doing a book on Frank, he got a little mad. Now, this is when he was irritated by Frank, and he says, why would anybody write a book on Frank? Granted, he's a good engineer, but, geez, he's not an artist or anything worth writing about. Let me get in touch with this guy. So I put Beefheart in touch with Wally, and I guess that's how he got into the book. I don't remember your name. Was your name mentioned in the book? Are you quoted?
Oh, sure it is. The bibliography at the back probably wasn't part of what you read.
Right. So
I have a copy sitting in my office.
Right.
Dave autographed that one, and then when the more recent edition was issued, we talked, and he sent me that and said thanks for the first round. By that time, of course, the internet world existed, and there the ability to accumulate citations of material on Frank was vastly different. Mine was all clip and paste, you know.
Right. So, so did you get to hear Dave's complaints about Frank or Frank's complaints about Dave in the middle of that in 71, 72 when they were trying to get the book out?
Frank spoke very briefly about Dave Wally, and actually Gail was probably more unhappy with him. David and I talked a few times, but I mean, it's not like we were close. I never met him in person. We always We always just talked on the phone and corresponded, and I thought he was a very funny person. I also, in my small way, tried to gentle down some of the harsh things that tended to get said.
So you were a bit of a mediator, but Frank, it was more talking to David than Frank. He only spoke once, you're saying, with Frank, but about David. But did you talk a bit about...
Frank didn't dwell on that at all.
Did you talk to Gail about it more?
I might have heard a sentence or two that was unflattering and nothing more.
Right. I know Frank...
Never had a conversation that I can remember.
Right. I remember Frank saying later, I don't know, a couple of years later, he said what he thought was a problem with David, that David was projecting on him maybe a father figure, and he said, I was forced to treat him like a psychiatric patient. That's what Frank said. And, of course, that wasn't what Dave Wally thought he was doing, and he was very upset about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's interesting. What did you say in your first meeting with Frank? What did you discuss? Did you have genuine questions you wanted to ask him about what he was doing, or did you just want to impress him with what you knew? How did you?
You mean when I talked to him backstage the first time?
The first time, yeah. What did you begin with? What topic?
I couldn't tell you. I don't have any idea.
So he didn't ask you to hang around or anything, but you met him a few times after that, and then he started to notice you.
Yeah, and we just started conversing, and the kind of conversations we had were a little bit of a change of pace from his standard fan conversations.
Right.
And we talked about the world beyond music and the world beyond what he was doing. And we shared an interest in a lot of topics. And so the conversations were a little bit more far-ranging.
Yeah. Did you ever hear him talking in that period, 71, 72, 73, about running for president? You remember he had the idea of the interested party?
Not seriously. I don't remember any serious comments.
Well, I think in 68
there were bumper stickers.
Yes. But in 68 he was talking about his interested party, that's what he called it. And he was talking about Tom Wilson being the candidate for the interested party. But we wouldn't put much into that, except that when I talked to Cal Schenkel years ago, he told me that Frank would talk about being president as something he would try to do years later. Cal Schenkel actually had conversations in 68, 69 about that. So that, to me, knowing that, I wondered if he had talked to you about it, because he was thinking it that early. But you don't...
Go ahead. We discussed political matters.
Right. Did you think... not knowing your political education, did you find Frank naive about the democracy, or cynical, or educated, or was he just a guy who had a sense of civilian responsibility? How would you say his political interests came across to you?
As of when?
In the early 70s, when you first were talking to him about the world.
Well, the nothing stands out other than we didn't have to discuss very much what we thought about Richard Nixon.
Yeah, right.
There was an understanding about his role in the universe.
Was Frank cynical? Okay, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, was Frank cynical about the Democratic Party at that point? Like McGovern?
I know very few subjects that Frank was not cynical about. Serious comment.
Is there any topic he wasn't cynical about that you can think of? Maybe his own music.
Frank had genuine friendships and relationships and his kids and they, you know, about people. There were people that he was not even remotely cynical about, who had earned his trust, but his trust wasn't easily granted. And the his own family, of course, was very important, and so the thing that Frank was generally cynical about, this is a commonplace observation, was what was motivating people who were seeking attention, who were trying to develop an audience, who were trying to be heard, what was motivating them? And what was motivating a fan who was trying to get his attention? And so on and so on and so on. And he had a great respect for how crazy people can be and how dangerously crazy people can be.
Right. So how soon did he get you interested in being a musical lawyer or a lawyer in the music industry?
Never. He never had anything to do with it. He was a completely unintended influencer, in the sense that the first client that developed into a large and multi-decade client called me up when, at the same venue that Frank was performing at, they were going to promote their second conference, and the manager of the venue, who's a employee of the state of Indiana. The Indiana State Fairgrounds is owned by the Indiana government, and this manager said that they could not book the venue unless he got a third of the profits. And they were looking for a lawyer to find out if that was lawful. And they called me up. I remember quite vividly. It was a Sunday. They called me up, and they were calling me up because they'd heard I was a friend of Frank's. And I'd had some parties for Frank when he performed here. And, again, this was around 71. And I started representing these people in late 71, early 72, and represented them for next 40-some years.
Why? Why is this?
But they only had heard about it. It had nothing to do with Frank. Frank did want me to be directly involved with him, and at one point I did assist on some things, but he wanted me to involved in a much larger way, and that's a memorable episode. It was a very difficult decision.
Okay, maybe you will address that in a minute, but why would your awareness of Zappa interest the people at the state fair? What's the connection there?
It didn't interest people at the state fair. It was of interest to a pair of concert promoters.
Oh, okay.
Who had just gotten into the business of promoting concerts, and they had had one, and it was successful. And one show, it was Isaac Hayes, Hot Buttered Soul era.
Yeah.
And they were about to do their second show at the same venue when they were told they would have to cut the venue manager in for a share of the profits, and they didn't think that was right and wanted a lawyer.
And so,
they thought I knew something about the concert industry because of my friendship with Frank. That's why they called me up.
Did you know anything about the concert industry?
Of course not.
Okay, so that's around...
But that was pretty easy to figure out.
Right. What, was it legal? What the manager was.
Oh, well, how does a public employee decide to cut themselves in for a percentage of profit on a rental of a state facility.
Right. That's right.
No, that's.
So you won the case for them?
What?
You won the case, or?
There was no case. That went away instantly. All it took was a couple of phone calls.
Right. Okay, so that's, is that 71, 72?
Yep.
Okay, so you meet Frank around 68, did you say? 68, 69.
Yes.
And you're already a good buddy by 71. And he's,
yes.
And he's inviting you out to, when do you first go to his place? That would be Woodrow Wilson Drive in 71, 72, if that's
when. That's it. '70 or '71, I think, is the first time I spent time there. And then I started going out on the road after that.
And can you go into what was the larger position he hoped you would engage with him?
Don't understand the way you're asking that.
Well, you're saying that he wanted you to help him a bit, but then he wanted you to get more involved. And
yes, he did, yes. It's
so,
not something I've talked about, but... late 1972, early 1973, Frank fired Herbie Cohen and asked me to take over.
And you were tempted. You're saying it was a hard decision.
Well, it was an easy decision. It was a painful decision, but it was easy. I had a six-month-old son, which I told Frank. He said, I want you here tomorrow. And I said, Frank, I've got a six-month-old baby. One of the great ironies of my life is that that baby, whose name was Aaron Zappa Bennett Pincus, grew up and with the clients that I mentioned to you first got in contact with me about the shakedown at the state fairgrounds. We developed venues, and one of the venues was originally called Deer Creek Amphitheater in north side of Indianapolis. It has been enormously successful. The place provided summer jobs for my eldest. And through that, he met various people in the music business. He was a gopher. That led him to helping out John Mellencamp, who, of course, is an Indiana native, but doing things for John Mellencamp. And so my eldest moves to L.A. Works for Mellencamp for a while, then joins William Morris. Was at William Morris 8 years plus, then joined Monterey Peninsula. It was acquired by Paradigm, and that's where he is today. He opened the first major agency office in Austin, Texas. And that's where he's based. And so I told Frank I couldn't go to L.A. because of the son who went into the music business.
Ended up in
and
L.A.
And moved to L.A.
Yeah.
And that's the irony.
Okay, so did Frank accept your practicality and how you couldn't do it right away?
Sure, yeah. And I helped on the agreements and so forth with the new manager.
You named your son Bennett. That's not after Bennett Glotzer, is it?
No.
Yeah. I think it was Glotzer was Frank's lawyer or something?
He was a – Bennett was the successor I one of the people I helped Frank on in the relationship.
Right. So did you see Frank much in 72 when he was, you know, laid up with the cast and the wheelchair and all that?
Yes, I have photographs of him. I was out there for a week. He was in the wheelchair. He was rehearsing. I did a large number of black and white photographs, some of which, without credits, which is fine, made it into his book, the real Frank Zappa book.
Those are your photos.
Well, the black and white shots of him in the wheelchair in a rehearsal room is, that's mine.
So what?
So I was out there then, and then we went on the road. I would, for summer vacations, and if he was touring, and he did, of course, many years in a row, I would go out with him for a week or so.
So, yes, he toured. I saw him in London in September 72 with the Grand Wazoo. So you toured a bit in late 72 with him, with Pete?
And 73 and 74.
How many years? Up to 77?
Oh, gosh. The tours got shorter because family and law practice made life more challenging to get away. But I'd say several years. I guess 76, 77.
Did your wife come with you?
At least I was still showing up for points in the road. I was at the final Fillmore East concert. I would show up at various places.
So you did you meet John and Yoko? They were there at that concert.
Well, I was actually in the audience and did not go backstage. I did have a pass. It was pretty wild, and I was exhausted from getting there. So no, I didn't. I was frankly quite irritated by Yoko's performance, which to me was pure nonsense.
Right.
You-lating, essentially.
Right, and so there was no charisma
for
there.
For 5 minutes at a time, and I thought, this is just complete nonsense. And I greatly respected their fame and their cultural importance, but I thought she was just an interference in the performance.
Right, and I think the mothers felt the same way.
Yeah.
They made negative comments. So I think in that show, that period.
I didn't know. I've never seen any comments by anyone on that. I never saw Frank say something harsh about
Well,
Yoko.
You know, I have a letter. Dave Wally gave it to me, I think. Who was the Howard somebody that Howard Smith or somebody wrote Village Voice articles? And I think he and Dave Wally went up to see Frank on the day in the afternoon, and out of that conversation, John and Yoko were invited. So Wally, I think, witnessed that. I was just wondering, maybe you saw Dave Wally at that point, that
nope.
day.
Nope.
All right. So he gave me a piece of one pager where Frank and John and Yoko were going to plan an art installation or something. So he writes this letter to them, saying for his contribution to it, they need to find a 39 Chevy, or maybe Studebaker Chevy or something, whatever, that 39 motif he would talk about, the 39 Chevy, and he last seen in California somewhere. So it was a sort of insulting instruction to them to find something that they would never find, and that was what he was going to put in the installation or joint art project. So I took from that that he was a bit peeved at them, and that's what that letter meant.
Well, that's an awful lot of interpreting. I couldn't join in any of that except to say that car is what I think is the inspiration of the Just Another Band cover.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same period.
Frank loved the look of those things.
No, that's right. No, he liked it. I'm just thinking, if I recall, that he made an absurd thing. Find this particular model or find something.
Well, he was probably deadly serious, is my guess. I've never seen that document, but I would guess he's completely serious. One of the things that always struck me about Frank was how concrete and specific his comments were, and they meant what they said.
Yeah. Another, he was kind of literal? Would you say
that? Yeah, often. Sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so let's see. So you're on the road with him, at least. Did your wife come with you?
No, it was me.
Right. So in our conversations, I don't know, a year or two ago, I was interested in the kind of things you talked about through those, say, 72, 73, 74. Is there any particular ideas that you heard from Frank that none of us ever heard in interviews or anything? Is there something you recall that you would talk about?
I'm sure there are quite a few, but but to answer a question that you're posing requires an encyclopedic knowledge of what already is out there.
Right.
I don't have that. So, I mean, I just, you know, I can't do a comparative analysis of, let's see, I know this. Has that been out there? I can't do that.
Okay, well, let me bring up some topics. Did he ever talk about himself as an anthropologist, which he once said? He studied people's behavior like an anthropologist. Did you ever hear him say that?
No, I don't recall that.
Do you recall him talking about being a journalist, which is something he would say in some interviews?
Well, he in the sense that music is a report about what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that would be obvious. It's not something he elaborated on with you.
Never as what we would recognize as a secret, or at least a somewhat secret ambition to be a traditional journalist, no.
Right. Okay, did he ever talk about his theories on time and space and physics, which he sometimes referred to?
Yes, and once Gail distilled her interpretation of that into a single paragraph, densely written paragraph, which she mailed to me. And it's one of many documents lost when there was a flood in the basement of my house, and which she never made a copy of it. And in much later years, was hoping I could find a copy. And I had to apologize. I said, well, you know, I just lost a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's gone because it was an important thing. And it was a paragraph about Frank sitting quietly in a corner knitting the project object. And it was her distillation of the space-time and really physics musings, the project object, something that you're in the midst of as a creator, but you're outside of it.
Yeah.
Simultaneously, things like that.
And
Frank and I talked a little about those things.
Right, so you're saying that he said some words and Gail wrote them down.
No, this paragraph that Gail sent was her take.
Yeah.
On the meaning of the project object.
Interesting, because I've heard glimpses of that about Gail interested in that part. I always look forward to a book or two that she might do that. And I think she said, I'm going to write about Frank's ideas that people don't know about. And that sounds like an example.
Yeah, and I think she was considering that, and she was very disappointed that that document was gone.
Right, because that
paragraph.
That would get her going if she could read that again. Would remind her.
Well, she didn't express it that way.
Right.
She just wanted to know if I had it and could I send a copy.
Because Dave Wally tried to get into that, a bit in his book. I guess he didn't have the science background, but he made a big deal about time. And there's this great quote that was in this interview that I used when I talked to him. It goes something like, time cancels time, therefore you're not going anywhere. And if you look at this phenomenon from a distance, it looks like a big object. That I could actually look it up, probably the quote at some point. But does that sound familiar? He says, time and maybe space are canceling each other out, therefore we're not going anywhere. And I remember he's saying, if you looked at this situation from a distance, it would look like an object. That would be project object. There's the word object.
Right. And the and that theme, not the words that you're using,
yeah,
but that theme would be part of conversations. But it wasn't, our relationship was not one where I was taking dictation.
Hmm.
I mean, we talked. My undergraduate philosophy major made me somewhat predisposed. I was also interested in science. I was also interested in electronics. One night when I was in L.A. with him, visiting him, we went to the garage-like lab of one of his inventor friends who was constantly tinkering with cheese boards of transistors,
yeah,
and capacitors to produce new sounds. We just had a confluence of interests, and
yeah,
we would talk about those things. The project object stuff was hovering in the background. Frank understood perfectly that music is largely a matter of slicing up bits of time, and the connection between math and music, of course, is intimate. And those things wove in and out of the conversations, but I don't remember blocks of, okay, now remember this one, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. So it wasn't until about an interview in April 75, I got to be on stage and backstage at the Long Island, was it Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, April 25th, 1975 concert with Beefheart there. Spent a lot of time with Beefheart, who I'd met before. There was an article in a magazine that I bought on the way to the concert, and it was the first time someone talked about Frank reading books like Günter Grass, the German novelist. Günter Grass, maybe even Pynchon was mentioned. And generally Frank would say he didn't read books, he'd fall asleep. But did you have a chance to talk to him about any novels or writers that we didn't hear in any interviews? Did you read novels and bring any of them up?
Frank had a robust vocabulary of literary references, but he was not a cover-to-cover reader, is what I would say.
Yeah. Yes, he said he just looked at a couple pages of James Joyce and said, that guy knew what he was doing, you know, but he just would dip into it.
Yeah. Very quick mind. I just saw a piece about why print text is not going to fade away in response to what I think was just a giddy, if not completely frivolous, comment by a person who was saying that the future in communication is video, video, video. And the explanation about why that really was not right
yes.
had to do with the incredible efficiency of text, where you can potentially acquire vast amounts of information by selective reading and scanning, looking at a few words here, a chapter heading, and so on and so forth. And that video was incapable of doing that. Even
yes.
searchable video was incapable of doing that. And that video was actually a very slow way to dispense information.
Yes.
And 5 minutes of video could, you know, the same amount of time of reading could reveal vast amounts of information, and 5 minutes of video would convey a very small number of ideas.
Right.
So the point of that little observation is that Frank could blow through things.
Yes.
With his wonderful mind, and he sometimes made incorrect deductions about the subject matter of written material, like we all do, from a few words here or there. But he derived a tremendous amount, and he didn't have to read the whole damn thing or anything close to it.
Yeah, it's interesting what you're talking about, because I was Marsh McLuhan's archivist, so I know a lot about different media, and I know what McLuhan had to say about these points, and
mm-hmm.
and he never said print would go away. He
no.
said we'd get more and more of it when he used the term.
Exactly, and,
yeah.
and so we are.
Yeah. He predicted that. He said when print is obsolete, that means it's not constitutive. The electric environment is what's molding the society stronger than print. But when something's obsolete, then there's more and more of it. So when the printing press came in, there was more and more handwriting, even though it was obsolete. And obsolete technically, handwriting was not molding the society. Print was. And so this ecology of ratios between media was the way to look at what McLuhan was talking about. And
I think those are, you know, those are insightful observations given the state of knowledge at the time. What we know now through brain imaging
yeah.
is that handwriting operates through different channels, different neural channels, than typing, for example.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, although handwriting is largely untaught in our schools, it is an artistic format in a way that typing is not, and it has distinct values for thinking and for creating. And so now we know there are neural reasons for that to be preserved, and we know more about the neural behavior that takes place when we're just passively staring at a screen.
Yeah, the professor was telling me a couple of years ago there's new neural research that proved McLuhan's point. Recent neural stuff is showing that McLuhan was on the right track. Which nobody knew back then, but he was, his intuition was accurate, or his guess. It worked out. Now, Frank seemed to be, he would often talk about different media. You know, he would say, well, when you take it this way, you get that effect. And when you look at it on the TV, it's this effect. He had a very, not complex like McLuhan's, but he was aware of the different media. And then he talked about that's how he recommended watching the news, you know, watch it in different formats. See different networks. Did he ever talk about that kind of thing to you? Like maybe be very concrete about, okay, well, if I do this in this form, but if I went over here and did it in that